Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, best-selling mystery novelist Amanda Flower discusses her latest multi-award nominated novel, Because I Could Not Stop for Death, an Emily Dickinson mystery. In this first book in an all-new series, Emily Dickinson and her housemaid Willa Noble realize there is nothing poetic about murder. Flower is joined by author and scholar Peter Coviello to discuss her book and Dickinson's literary legacy. The following conversation originally took place March 26th, 2023, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
Thank you all for being here and supporting the past, present, and future of American writing. When Emily Dickinson died in 1886, her obituary stated that very few in the village, excepting among the older inhabitants, knew Miss Emily personally. Although the facts of her seclusion and her intellectual brilliancy were familiar Amherst traditions. In the century plus since that was written, Emily Dickinson's appeal as a writer, literary figure, muse, influence, and leading lady of stage and screen has only continued to grow. Every generation tells its own story of Emily, from publications of her letters to retellings of her life, and now she's starring in a murder mystery. Here today to discuss Emily's lasting appeal and latest iteration are two of her biggest fans, Amanda Flower and Peter Coviello. Amanda is the author of the Edgar, Mary Higgins Clark, and Agatha Award-nominated book, Because I Could Not Stop for Death, the first in an all-new series featuring Emily and her housemaid, Willa Noble. Amanda is a USA Today best-selling Agatha Award-winning author of over 35 mystery novels. Her novels have received starred reviews from Library Journal, Publishers Weekly, and Romantic Times, and she's been featured in USA Today, First for Women, and Woman's World. Dr. Coviello is a writer of criticism, scholarship, and literary nonfiction. He's written about step-parenthood, Mormon polygamy, queer children, pop heartbreak, Whitman and Dickinson, and the American history of sexuality. He taught for many years at Bowdoin College and since 2014 has been at the University of Illinois Chicago, where he's a professor and head of English. Please join me in welcoming both.
Thank you, Allison.
Allison, thank you very much. And thank you all for coming out on this beautiful springtime Sunday in Chicago. It's great to see you. And Amanda, it's great to be here with you.
It's great to be here with you too. I'm so excited to talk to you guys about Emily Dickinson.
So I think what's going to happen is Amanda and I are going to speak for a while, which is to say I'm just going to ask Amanda some questions and ask her to speak about Emily Dickinson and the book, and then we'll open it up to questions. That's how we're going to do. So, thank you for your book and thank you for making it to Chicago
You're
today.
You're welcome.
My first question is really what drew you to, like, why Emily Dickinson of all the figures in 19th and 20th century or 21st century literature to draw from? Why Emily Dickinson for you particularly?
Well, I mean, I've always loved Dickinson. So I was first introduced to her when I was 15 in your like standard American literature class. And at that point, I already knew I wanted to be a mystery writer. And I think her morbid focus on death and things like really drew me as a person that loved mysteries and things like that. And so I've always like kind of studied her. I definitely would always be that person, like if there was a mug with an Emily quote on it, I was like, oh, I need that. And then years later, I was writing mysteries full time and I had been a librarian for 15 years. So I left, I retired from being a librarian to write completely full time. And Emily came to me on a drive to Iowa, of all places. My husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, we were gonna go visit, we live in Ohio, and we were driving across 90 to go to his family in Des Moines, Iowa, so I could meet them. And while we're driving there, I kept like lamenting, you know, I wanted to write a bigger book now. I love cozy mysteries and I will always write them. But I wanted a more challenge. I think as a writer, you always want to grow and change and get better. So I was thinking of different ideas and I really loved the retellings of like Jane Austen books where the characters solved crimes and stuff. And my scholarship had always been in transcendental 19th century New England American literature. So I was like, gosh, I wonder if I'm like, oh, probably someone's written a mystery about Emily Dickinson. I obviously could not be the only one that had this idea before. So I, you know, while we're, my husband, now husband, and was driving, I get on Amazon. I was like, huh, there's none. And then I was a librarian, so I got on WorldCat. You know, I also checked the old stuff that's not for sale anymore. There was nothing. And so I was like, oh my gosh. And just serendipity, my agent called me about some business matter while we were on the road, and I pitched the idea to her, and she's like, do it. And then I was like, oh, what did I do? I can't, you know, like, who am I to like tell, like, write as Emily Dickinson? So, but that's kind of how it started.
That's good. I wonder if you could talk, I think for a lot of us, it's there's nothing sort of like automatic about the connection between Emily Dickinson and mystery.
Yeah.
One could think of Emily Dickinson and a million other things, lyric poetry, only one of them, or teenage romance even.
Yeah.
But tell me how Emily Dickinson refracted itself for you into mystery. That's super interesting.
Yeah. I loved Emily Dickinson, and back in 2016, one of my mysteries I wrote was called Crime and Poetry. And it's one of the Magic Bookshop Mysteries. It's a series of five books set in Niagara Falls, and they solve the mystery using 19th century literature. So it's a paranormal mystery. So the bookshop will give them clues with quotes. In the very first book, they use Emily Dickinson because I loved her and I knew her stuff. And so I had that tie with mystery and Emily. I knew that her words could be like, her words can be construed all kinds of ways, but it could be work in a mystery. And then to make her the sleuth, I think the reason I thought about that was because I knew, but a lot of the general public doesn't know, is she was not a recluse her whole life. And I wanted to show her when she was active and traveling around the country at the time and, you know, possibly solving a murder.
Well, that's wonderful. So I know from reading the book and from having read that this also required some like investigations of your own and some research both into Dickinson's life and into the life of Amherst and stuff like that. I wonder if you'd talk some about that, about the getting underway with your own investigations.
Yeah, it was such a daunting thing that, you know, once I pitched it to my agent, it was like kind of no going back, because she was like really like, you can always, you know, if you're a writer, you can always tell if your literary agent like likes an idea or not. Like, oh, that's not, you know, she was like, get it to me, and, you know, so many days. And I was like, okay. So I, you know, immediately like dove into it. Thankfully, you know, I was a librarian for so many years, so like I have so many librarian connections. So I was like, hey, I don't have access to Academic ILL anymore, but can you get me, you know, this article that, you know, that's in this obscure journal somewhere? So that was a great help. But the things that I learned along the way about her that I didn't even know, and I, you know, been dabbling and studying her pretty much my whole life, was that she did go to Washington, D.C. in 1855. And when I learned that, that's when I figured out the year that the book would be set, because, like, I think most people don't know that. I didn't know that. And, you know, what a great thing to have Emily running around the unfinished Washington Monument looking for a killer. I felt like would be very appropriate for a mystery novel. So, and then as far as Amherst, it was really like, the wonderful thing is her papers, her letters. So the letters that she received were all burnt at her request. Her sister burnt them for her. She actually asked her maid to burn all of her poems, but the maid didn't, and that's how we have them today. But like the letters she wrote other people, all of her poems, all of that's been digitized by Harvard or Amherst College. The collection is divided, and we could certainly talk about how that ended up being divided. And so it was easy for me to go in there. And also, they also have them transcribed because her handwriting is terrible. It's really hard to read. So they would transcribe it. You could look at the actual scan copy and be like, I have no idea. And then someone typed it, thankfully. So that was helpful. And then I also looked at a lot of historical maps because I wanted to make sure, like if I said Emily and Willa, Willa's the narrator of the story, because I did not think I could write in Emily Dickinson's voice, or on a certain street, I wanted to put their feet firmly on that street. So, yeah.
Could you talk to folks some about an interesting part of the book is that it takes place from the perspective of a house servant. And house servants are not, again, a thing you want to immediately think about in reading the corpus of Emily Dickinson. Can you tell me how you both thought that this would be a great angle into Emily Dickinson and how you sort of expanded your knowledge about what it would be to be of the working classes rather than of the more elite classes like the Dickinsons?
Yeah, so I really needed a character that could connect with Emily and explain what's going on in more of a plain voice, because even my character Emily in the story, like sometimes she's saying stuff and Willa doesn't really know what she's talking about because she's in her head, she's working through a poem. And just like any writer, I think sometimes we mumble to ourselves or narrate our life or whatever because we're talking through like what we're writing. So imagine if you're like a great genius like Dickinson, you're probably doing that all the time. So in the case of Willa, I found this amazing book called Made as Muse, and it was written like 1996, and I apologize. It's actually in my acknowledgement, so the author's name and everything, but I can't remember her name right now, that was about all the servants in the Dickinson household and how they, and it's, so it's a nonfiction, and how they influenced Dickinson as a writer, because she spent, especially when she was a recluse, she was mostly with her sister and then all the servants. You know, her parents were gone at that point, and her brother and his family lived in the next property over. I'm sure they went back and forth all the time. But so I was just like, oh, this is perfect because this person can see Emily like maybe a normal, you know, like not normal, but like a common person, and look at Emily and have, you know, those conversations and kind of not know what she's talking about. Mm. And, but because of it, Emily will say things, and it's kind of Easter eggs in there for the reader that knows things about her that Willa might not understand, but the reader would pick up on.
That's, by the way, Aife, so I'll probably get that pronunciation horrifically wrong. Aife Murray, and she wrote Made as Muse, How Servants Changed Emily Dickinson's Life and Language. But that's right. Mm-hmm. Like Emily Dickinson, famously, her high period is to the 1860s, at which point it drops off considerably. But that's also because she's caring for her mother in a full-time way, which contributes to her homeboundedness.
Yes.
To ask a question about the opposite of homeboundedness, you're concerned in the book too to speak about the Underground Railroad, and the Underground Railroad as it went through places like Amherst and sort of small town, semi-elite New England. Could you talk a little bit about how you did investigations into that aspect?
Yeah. I mean, when I realized the book wasn't going to be in 1855. You know, that was another moment of fear for me, because what was the most encompassing thing going on in the 1850s in American history, you know, of course, was slavery and dealing with the issue of slavery, and, you know, the North and South debate and even everything that was going on. And the thing is, Dickinson herself never wrote about it specifically. You know, there's been maybe some interpretation, like maybe she was talking about it and this, but she never like specifically word for word gave her stance on slavery. And I think one reason that could be, I mean, she never really affiliated with a party, but her father was a Whig. So as such, you know, it's, they were kind of middle of the road, like, let's just keep the peace and prosper the country kind of thing. Let's not get in any arguments, which eventually led to the demise of the party completely, because you need to pick a side on this issue, and because there's a clear right and wrong. So, I mean, that was terrifying to take on the subject matter, but I thought not writing about it would have been irresponsible. Because, like, I can't write about the 1850s and not include slavery in some way. Now, I guess, you know, including the Underground Railroad, I just went for it. You know, I went for it in a big way. But the reason I went there is when I was a librarian, one of my jobs was leading Underground Railroad tours of the town where my library was. So we would stop at all, and I'm from Northern Ohio, so similar, like we're, you know, last stop before Canada kind of situation. So I would take people to different houses and say, like, tell them the story about, a slave that came through here, or a conductor that used this house, or the family that lived there. And just one of the houses that the town I'm talking about is Hudson, Ohio, which ironically is where Emily Dickinson's grandfather died.
Really?
Yes. When he left Connecticut in shame because he lost all the family's money, he went to Ohio. So, and he died in Hudson. But like one of the town founder, like David Hudson, hid runaway slaves in, he had like this, an old well house. So that's where they would hide in this like shanty around the well kind of thing. So, I knew a lot about it from talking about it. And I've always thought it was fascinating. And, so that's kind of how I ended up there, but I was really conscious of, you know, being responsible writing on the subject matter. So even before I wrote the book, I wrote my editor, like, this is the direction I'm going. I think we need to hire some authenticity readers, and Penguin did that. So they had three different African-American editors read the book to just make sure that I was being sensitive to the topic. As a white woman, my perspective might be different. So, and they really didn't have me change too much, but I just wanted to do that extra due diligence.
What now that you've done this, now that you said you looked for this challenge and you wrote this new kind of book, like, how do you see this book in relation to the books that came before it? You know what I mean? Like, how does this, over the trajectory of the things that you've written, and you've written a great deal, how does this arrive on that path for you?
You know, I think it's not a book that, when I, you know, my very first novel was called Made a Murder, and it was about a college librarian in a small town in Ohio, which was exactly what I was at the time. And, you know, they tell you to write what you know, and it was a murder mystery. I've never murdered anyone or caught a killer, but I knew how to be a librarian.
As far as anyone here knows.
As far as anyone knows. And then everything I've written since has been further and further away from myself. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, you know, it's just, as you get more confident as a writer, you're like, well, I don't just have to write what I know anymore. I can write what I'm interested in. And I had always been interested in Dickinson. I'd always been interested in 19th century literature. And it was mostly like building the confidence to think I could do it. And then also, you know, writing's a craft. So building the craft that, like, I could confidently have the appropriate wording and everything that you need to write a book that, you know, is a little bit more challenging. So if anyone reads Made of Murder, and because I could not stop to death for death back to back, let me know if there's been some growth. I hope so.
Well, I have several more questions, but one of them is, like, so after having written this, after having come to this and brought yourself this challenge and then met it, what do you intend to do next around this? Will you stay in the 19th century? Or are you going to try the 17th century? You know what I mean?
I'm definitely going to write more historical. I just love it. I love the research, you know, having been a librarian, it's just, that's the really fun part. And sometimes I just have to, like, be like, you know, enough to write something. We can look up the little, you know, little facts later and, you know, just leave a space for it. Cause, you know, I can get like, what kind of pencil did she use? Like, it could go really, really deep and things like that. So I will continue to write those. The second book comes out in November. It's called I Heard a Fly Buzz When I Died, which is another, luckily Emily has a lot of first lines with death in the beginning of it. So hopefully the series will be able to go through all of them. So, and that one involves Emerson comes to Amherst, which is true, although I played with the timeline a little bit. I made him come earlier so that Emily wasn't a recluse already, so she could interact with him. And he's doing a writing like symposium talking about English Traits was his book that came out in 1856. And he's there, and of course, you know, someone gets killed. His secretary gets killed, and they have to investigate. And there's all these, like, well, like Louisa May Alcott makes an appearance. So it's like, if you're an English geek, like, this is the one for you, because like there's all these people, they make reference to Thoreau and all those guys. So that's been really fun to write. But in addition to that, I had recently just signed a contract to write a mystery series about the Wright brothers. So now I'm getting even further away from something that I know, because, you know, I don't know how to fly a plane or, you know, or like anything about, like, you know, I'm reading books about them and learning about pitch and roll, and I still don't really understand it, but I know how to kill someone in fiction and solve the crime. So the story is narrated by their sister, Catherine Wright, who was an amazing woman in her own right. She was the only one to go to college. She graduated from Oberlin, and she was a Latin teacher. She was also a leader in the women's suffrage movement in Ohio, and got her brothers and her father to go on a march with her. And this was after the brothers were famous too, so it was quite a big deal. And she was just a really interesting, and she was like kind of their social calendar. So she worked, they worked in the bicycle shop, handled a lot of their business, but people don't really know about her. Mm-hmm. And so the first book will come out next March, and they're still debating the title. So unfortunately, I don't, like, the publisher's like, I don't like that title. So we're doing that like shift back and forth right now, mm-hmm. why they settle on the title. So that's what I'm working on, and I'm really excited about that. That series will be at least three books. And Catherine had such a big life that she went to France with them when they went to France. So I don't know, maybe I have to go to Paris to research that one. That would be great.
Yeah, that's well planned.
Yeah, yeah.
I think she probably went to Rome a couple
times. Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. That's altogether good. Well, I want to turn it over to the folks in the audience. Before I do it, I'd be curious to know how your relation to Dickinson as a writer, as a poet who's meant something to you over a scope of years, how that's changed or what's crystallized about, you know what I mean? Like, what aspects of Dickinson are refreshed for you, mm-hmm. or are seen differently, having written this book and having spent this much time inside Amherst and inside that scene and thinking about her life there and all that sort of stuff?
You know, a lot has changed. Like, I think of her as a person now.
Yeah.
Before, she was just kind of like a great mind in my head, or when I would read her poems, it'd be like what her poems meant to me. And now because I've put myself in her shoes or in the shoes of characters in her life and her family, I'm like, what did that mean to her? You know, and that's just my guess, because obviously I don't know for sure. And I also, like, you know, I think from what I've learned about her is she was, you know, very witty and smart, and she wasn't necessarily just sitting around thinking about death all the time. Or like staring at.
Though that's cool. Although that's totally cool. Fine. Yeah.
I mean, I think about it a lot. and she wasn't like just staring at bees and like talking about how the intricate things about bees in her poetry and all those things. She was actually a person with her feet on the ground and had a life, and the people in her life were so important to her. And I think the other thing that I've really learned is which I didn't know was like how codependent the family was on each other. Mm. Like her father would, you know, do things that make it pretty much impossible for them to separate. Like in actuality, her brother Austin wanted to move out west, like a lot of young men in the 19th century, and, you know, make his own way in the world, get on the wagon train or whatever it might have been. But his dad's like, I'm going to build you a huge Georgian house next door, and here's a job at my law firm. And, you know, of course, he picked that for the security aspect. So it was just, it makes me wonder, you know, it makes more sense to me why she stayed and maybe why her and her sister never got married. And also, you know, I also have a lot of respect for her father too, because she would not go to church. She was not religious at all. Or her religion was in nature. Like she had a different, it's not traditional religion. And he didn't make her go, even though he was like one of the fathers of the Congregational church in town, which is kind of shocking for the time period. And also he knew that she would wander around town whether he wanted her to or not. So instead of telling her no, he just bought her a huge dog and he got her a Newfoundland which she named Carlo after a character in Jane Eyre, which, you know, the English nerd in me loves that. So, you know, I love that. Like they were just so tight. Like they knew she was different, but they accepted her the way she was, which was pretty unusual for the time period.
I mean, that's wonderful. We talked about this a little before. As a person who also writes about Dickinson, in part, as with you, as with many of you, sort of being captivated at some point or other in the trajectory of your life by this spiky, strange, mysterious, mystic poetry. Mm-hmm. What I discovered was that she was a person capable of great intensities of heartbreak. Mm-hmm. And that was very moving to me. That's when you spend a lot of time with them. I think so that makes great sense to me. Thank you very much. Shall we take questions from the audience, Allison? Does that sound right? Why don't we do? Yeah.
I was very intrigued by your statement that you knew you wanted to be a mystery writer at the age of 15. So I would like you to expand on that and specifically address what mystery series you read as a child. I'm assuming you did.
I did. I almost exclusively read mystery, and I almost still exclusively write mystery, except for nonfiction for all my research. I was one of those kids that, like, as soon as I learned to read, I was like, this is the best thing ever. Like, you know, like where you would just like go to the library and, you know, 20, 30 books, and we would go once a week, and I just have like a huge stack. What I was really drawn to, and I'm going to date myself, was the Babysitter Club mystery series.
Yeah.
I loved the Babysitter Club, but then they had this spinoff mystery series, and I was like, oh, here's my favorite babysitters, and now they're finding lost puppies. This is the best. And the thing was, and then I read Nancy Drew Files and the original Nancy Drew as well. As I was a kid of the early 90s kind of thing, the Files felt hipper to me, I guess, you know. And then there really wasn't any other mystery for my age group at the time. So I jumped immediately into adult mystery. So I am like 13, reading Patricia Cornwell, Donna Andrews, Sue Grafton, you know, all these mystery writers. And the reason I kind of was drawn to that genre is like my mother was a massive mystery fan. She was a Presbyterian minister, had two kids, and was married. She's super busy, but she would still read 5 mystery novels a week. I can't do that now. Like, I don't have any kids. So she just plowed through mysteries. So there was always some there from her pile that I would take to, and I would read them. So I knew actually when I was 11 that I wanted to be an author full time. Like I had an epiphany moment in front of my class and made a big announcement and the whole thing very confidently. So when it was time to I'm going to write my first novel, it never was even a question. It was always going to be mystery. And even when I met my agent, I was like, I will write whatever you want me to write in outer space, about the Amish. I write a lot of Amish books, anything, but you just have to let me kill people and solve the crime. That's my only requirement.
We have a few people asking questions online. We have over 100 people streaming right now.
Awesome.
So this is from Kathy. This is kind of a two-part question. Are you a pantser or a plotter? And how did you keep from letting history research not become the focus or take away from the character?
I am 100% a pantser. I have no idea what I'm doing when I'm writing. And I've written over 50 novels at this point. Some are still in the pipeline to get published. So I usually have a kernel of an idea, and then I sit down and I start drafting, and then I cry some because I don't know what I'm doing, and then I'll rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. As far as bogging down in the research, I think there, I've gotten to a point with my writing that I know that point when I know enough to tell a story. Like my dad used to have this phrase, he's like, know enough to be dangerous, kind of thing. So you just know just enough that you can tell a story. And then I know where to get all the details when I need them. So like when I was writing the first Emily book, I didn't necessarily know what she was gonna wear to Washington, DC, because I needed to look up the clothes and stuff. So the first draft says like, she's wearing a dress. You know, I knew she wasn't wearing pants. It was kind of like a stopper there. And then when I'm writing the manuscript, I will highlight it. So when I'm going back through edits, I'm like, oh, you need to go look this up. So it's kind of how I do it. I do a big research. I do kind of, my initial research is broad. So I read a ton of biographies about her to get like the higher view of Emily and her life and her emotions and feelings. Like that's the most important to me. And then when I actually have written the book, then I'll go into the details, like what street did they live on, or you know, what did the hotel look like in Washington, D.C.? And then I'll go look up pictures and things like that.
So you clearly have written a lot of books. Mm-hmm. So what is your process? How many do you churn out in a year? And do you work 40 hours a week?
Oh, I wish. I work much more than that. I work 7 days a week. I've written as many as 9 books a year. I do not recommend that. I almost, my husband can attest, I was pretty much in tears for 12 months trying to do that. So right now I'm writing 4 books a year, which is still way a lot. Like it's still a pretty aggressive schedule, especially when 2 of them a year is a historical now. So I have to take that into account. But my process is, usually how a book starts for me, if I already have an editor that I'm working with, I will like pitch an idea to her. I've been writing particularly for Kensington a very long time, like over 10 years. So I'll just send her like a one sentence thing and she's like, okay, I'll take it to pub board and, you know, and my agent does all that other negotiation stuff and they decide if they like it or not. And then, you know, I signed the contract. So far I have like 3 sentences and now I've sold a 3 book series on 3 sentences and then I'm in trouble because they'll give me the due date and the due date feels like this far off thing, like maybe like could be 9 months. It could be 2 years away. And I'm like, it'll be great. Don't worry about it. And then we get into like the 4-month of the due date zone. And that's when I start thinking about it. So I have a book due June 15th and I have not started it yet. So that gives you kind of an idea. So I have my laptop and I will start it on the drive home when my husband's driving. But my process is look at that little, what I wrote, try to make a story out of it. And I just start to free write. And then I'd write what's called a fast draft. So that it's like kind of a skeleton of a book. You know, the character dies and we find out who did it and everything. And then I will go over it completely two more times before I send it to my agent, who will, she's kindly reads, not all agents do that, but she kindly reads all my books before I turn them in. And each time it's like building a cake is how I describe how I write. I start with just like the bare cake, and then every draft it gets prettier and prettier and prettier, and finally you have this beautiful color, sometimes with too many flowers maybe and all this stuff on the cake. So that's kind of my process. And then what I'll say is every writer has a different process. There is no right process. I have friends that sit down and write like a detailed 30-page outline, and I'm just like, wow, that would be nice to like know what you're doing. Like but I've tried that before, and then it just, the book was so stagnant and trapped for me that I ended up rewriting it again. So it kind of felt like a waste of time. So whatever works for you.
A question from Cynthia online. Do you see Emily Dickinson as a transcendentalist? In what ways might she differ?
She was not officially a transcendentalist. She was a contemporary for sure with Emerson and Thoreau. But I think the way that the similarities are, you know, the preoccupation with nature. But I don't think Emily had the same transcendental thing of like continual self-improvement. And maybe you can comment. I mean, she always wanted to make her writing better, but like they thought of things like economy and organizing. When she was a writer, it was, you know, the one thing that Emily and I connect on as writers is we're very messy at it. Like scraps of paper all over the place. And that's something Willa comments. She doesn't want to go into her room and, you know, even dusting the place. She's like so nervous because she might move something and it might mess up Emily's train of thought. I kind of work the same way. Like you always know when I'm in a manuscript because my office is a disaster. I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Thought that was a great answer. The very short version for me would be no, for all the reasons you said. Yes, because like Emerson or the transcendentalists, she thought really hard about the relation between nature, the things in the world that were moving very fast in front of you all the time, and language as a difficult, prickly, resistant system. Mm-hmm. And so for Emerson, the job was like how to renovate language so it moves as fast as nature so that it's not always lagging behind.
Yeah.
Dickinson does that, but she does it with that intense compression, mm-hmm. like taking apart the sentence and making the poem open up in all these different ways all at once. So that would be my sense of how they belonged in the same place at the same time. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that'll be great to see them together.
Yeah.
In 1956
yeah.
Really, at Emerson.
And yeah. I'm excited about this new book. You know, also maybe it's a little self-indulgent as a writer, but they have a lot of conversations about writing. And then she has conversation with Louisa May Alcott about writing. I mean, they're not long passages, just little bits, because I'm sure my editor would be like, all right, got to find the killer here. Back it off. But
yeah, syntax is interesting as far as it goes. Yeah.
But like, especially with Louisa, you know, for their difference, and Louisa was not in transcendentalist either, but her father was, Bronson Alcott. Louisa wrote to live, and Emily, you know, she lived to write. Like that was, and Louisa was more pragmatic and practical because, you know, her father kept squandering away money and she had to take care of the family.
She wrote a book called Work.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. Yeah.
Do you change the killer as you go along?
It's a great question. I have. In this case, I think I probably did, because the thing is, I don't know who the killer is until the main character does, because I'm a pantser, so I don't really go into it knowing what's going to happen. But I have had situations with other books where I got to the end, I wrote a certain killer, and then I was like, oh man, that's the wrong person, because I knew that maybe it was too obvious, or too obscure, or in my mind there was this other character that's like, I did it, and you're like, oh. And sometimes as a writer you just want to be like, shut up, no, leave me alone, let me be in my happy place and thinking it's done. But I would tell people that want to write, or writers, if you have that gut feeling that something's wrong with your book, something's wrong with your book, or something's wrong with your work, and you need to fix it as much as you don't want to, because you know how much work it's going to be. So I've had that happen a couple times, which is sad.
There's Emily online, not the Emily. What does it mean to you being a woman writing about such influential women like Emily Dickinson?
I mean, it means so much. It's, we're having this event during Women's History Month. And if there hadn't been writers like Dickinson, I wouldn't be doing what I do and doing what I love. And there were times that, she was interested in getting published, never really seriously, because she was more interested in the creation and perfecting her poems. If you look at her poems, the handwritten ones, she would scratch out words all the time and replace it. And I'm sure the people that edited her poems which word should I pick? Because one of them's kind of scratched out and the other one's kind of scratched out. So they had to make those decisions. It was so hard. If she had decided it gets published, how is she going to do it? Being a woman, it's harder. And then what I really think about a lot with her is, she never got married. There's millions of reasons how we can go over why she didn't get married. But if she had gotten married, the writing would have been pretty much over, because now she's expected to take care of a home and children. And even with her, her biggest period of writing was during the Civil War. And then at the end of the Civil War, the maid that they had at the time, Margaret, left because she got married. So now Emily and her sister have to do, until they could find more help, do all the cleaning and taking care of this big house because her mom is ill. And so her writing dramatically takes a nosedive, because they just didn't, think of how long it takes to wash a shirt back then. So it just takes so much time, and she wouldn't have had that creative energy. It also makes me think too, because her father had money and she had privilege in that way, she was, think of how many characters like a Willa or someone that could have produced some amazing writing but couldn't, because they're just trying to survive and take care of, putting food on the table and things like that. So I think about that a lot, because just like any trailblazing woman, she paved the way for writers to come, and I'm grateful. And I'm a very active member of Sisters in Crime, which is a writer's organization that promotes female crime writers. And also that we do let men into, we sometimes refer to ourselves as sisters and misters. And the whole point of that, why it was started, was because back in the 80s, it was really hard for women to break into crime fiction. And And those women that started it, like Sarah Paretsky and other authors, Sarah Paretsky from Chicago, made it possible for, by the time I came along, my path was a lot easier. So
this has been fascinating. Since you write so many mysteries, do you ever feel like you're running out of ideas for the murder weapon or who finds the body or where the murder happens, et cetera?
Yes, all of the above. Yeah, that, I mean, that is something that my husband and I talk about all the time. So he's been really helpful, probably the last 20 books that helped me kill people, because he has some creative ideas. But because, you know, I'll be like, oh, I'm writing this book and, you know, I want the character to, like, because I always kind of know, like, where I want them to die. Like, I want them to clap, you know, fall down in a garden or something. So I was like, I need something to happen to him. And I was like, there's people around, so we can't shoot him because then they'll hear it. So, you know, we've thought of probably my favorite one that he thought of was, like, I wrote a mystery series that was one of my Amish books, and I needed to blow up a still and have, like, the shrapnel kill someone. I know that's awful. But, like, he knew how to do it. Like, he told me what gun to use and where to shoot the you know, the gas tank of the still or the propane tank, and it worked. So yeah, sometimes I have to ask for, because I've written so many. And then poor David, my husband, a lot of times he'll be like, what about this? And I was like, oh, I did that before. Like, at least like six or seven. We'll go through like six or so. I was like, oh no, I've already poisoned someone with that or whatever.
So if anyone needs any advice, David's in the back. I want to thank you both for being here, and I want to thank all of you for coming. If you don't yet have a copy of Amanda's book, you can get it in the back from Seminary Co-op, and Amanda will be signing up here towards the front. Let's give our participants one more round of applause. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, a panel of Chicago poets reads from and discusses their contributions to the recent collection Wherever I'm At, an anthology of Chicago poetry, recorded live at the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.